So yeah, what I'm going to be talking about today are the policy strategies that we've used to replicate Pennsylvania's Fresh Food Financing Initiative. And so what I'm going to do is go over for you a little bit of a background about the food trust just briefly, and then kind of dive into the framework that really we use to replicate the Fresh Food Financing Initiative in other states. Go through a little bit of the data that we have around that, and then give you some updates on what's going on with the national initiative, the Healthy Fresh Food Financing Initiative, and I don't have any financial relationships to disclose. So the mission of the Food Trust is to provide access to affordable, nutritious food for all people. We've been around since 1992, and we're actually began as part of the Reading Terminal Market, which, if any of you are familiar with, Philadelphia is a really cool indoor market. And the idea was that we could try and bring more Reading Terminal Markets to people in communities. And then we grew to kind of couple that with more educational and policy work. And so now, really, what we do is around increasing access directly through work like the supermarket campaign, which I'm going to dive into in a minute. Our corner store initiative, which right now is recruiting 1,000 corner stores across Philadelphia, and coupling that work with schools, 200 schools across the city, doing educational efforts that match up, mirror kind of the access work that's going on in the corner stores. Farmers markets have always been part of our portfolio as well. And as I mentioned, we do a lot of nutrition education. We're the farm-to-school regional coordinator, so we have some farm-to-school programming that we do and also help to coordinate. And then we do more policy and advocacy work like menu labeling, school beverage policy, and research is my kind of arm of things, so we have a portfolio of research as well. And then we do consulting around those kinds of components. So what's the Fresh Food Financing Initiative? Well, back in 1999, we recognized in Philadelphia, really, that's where it kind of all started, that there was a lot of neighborhoods that used to have supermarkets that didn't anymore. And it's a pretty common problem. Most people on the street could tell you that they knew that there used to be something there. People left the city, went to the suburbs, and no longer were there these markets. And at the same time, we started to hear more and more about chronic disease issues. Obesity was on the rise. And so we started to kind of look into this issue as one from both an economic development perspective and also one of chronic disease prevention. So our goal is really, as we talk about the Fresh Food Financing Initiative, to address both of those issues. So this is an overview of the process, which is also published in the journal Health Affairs in the March issue of this year. And what it really defines is really the structures and the strategies that we use to move from this kind of early compilation of evidence, where we started to put together some policy briefs and reports and documents that summarized the research to date, all the way through to where we worked on establishing an incentive program. And truthfully, there's a whole nother bit that flies off the right end of this, which is once you get a program going, how do you manage it, and who are the partners when you're getting things in the system that this doesn't really address. So I'm going to start and just give you a brief overview of the kinds of evidence that we work to compile and the way that we've done it. So I call this phase kind of prepare and inform, where we start by really going in, looking at a couple different factors. This is an example of one of our final maps in our report, which typically includes 6 maps. And in our 6 maps, the first is really where supermarkets are, and then the next is where they aren't. And that is considered in response to population density and also poverty levels. And then we usually overlay, in addition, diet-related death, which folks always ask, what is that? And it's really, we worked with a team of physicians to define ICD, this was ICD-9, now we're at ICD-10 codes, that reflected primary reasons for death that were related to diet. And they ended up going really through an exclusionary procedure where they kind of excluded anything that was not related to diet. So at the end of the day, in most states, this looks like about 53% of the causes of death. The other thing we did as we're moving for the Healthy Fresh Food Financing Initiative work is myself and Sarah Trueft from PolicyLink compiled the most thorough research that I know of to date, looking at 132 studies and 20 years of research of what has been published across sectors on the topic of the grocery gap. We tried to really hone in on health, but there's some other issues that are also covered in the report. And this is available for free on our website or on PolicyLink's website. So that's kind of the prepare and inform stage, where we're compiling evidence. And next, we really get to what I'm calling empower. And the reason we call it empower is because it's really an intensive conversation that we're having with a diverse group of stakeholders across the industry, business, community leaders, policy folks, and child nutrition advocates to identify what they see as the issues in their community, talk about what's kind of already going on there, and really start to get to on the ground level of where people stand when it comes to this issue. So we talk to stakeholders and identify any ongoing activities, analyze that. We do a lot of networking via outreach and phone calls and with folks on the ground. And it's interesting because we kind of have this four-meeting policy. So it really takes, in our opinion, four meetings before you can really start to have frank, open discussions with someone. So we kind of have anticipation with the first meeting is just kind of a nice to get to know you, and it won't be till the fourth meeting where you really kind of get to the bottom and have dug in deep on things. We also work to identify leaders, and so the way that this project has been working is that we partner with one or more local organizations to convene a multi-sector task force. And so the task force is 30 to 35 members, two co-chairs, usually one from industry and one from a child health advocate. So that way we really get representation from both sectors and a balance in the conversation, and we work pretty intimately with those co-chairs to kind of craft the way that the meetings will go and use some of the existing materials that we have to help kind of nurture the process along. So then we get into the process really itself. So we've worked to kind of come up with the evidence that identifies why this area is of interest for people. We've talked extensively with people across a broad range of community, and usually that takes about 9 months to a year to kind of complete, depending on the process in that state. And then we work to really convene this task force and identify strategies. The goal of the task force is really to come up with the strategies. So while we may think that we have an idea of what a community needs, it's not until the task force meets that really everything kind of starts to emerge. And it's been very different from state to state. You know, a lot of states have decided to take on a financing kind of approach, but in others, zoning has been a critical issue, or insurance costs were really big. Sometimes kind of policing issues around security have come to the forefront. So it really depends. And a lot of times they end up actually issuing more than one recommendation. So they'll come up with 10 or around that number depending on the area. So task force members usually have four meetings. We only ask for four. This is not the never-ending thing that we've all been part of, I'm sure, sometimes, where you just keep meeting and you're not sure where this is all going. It's just four meetings. They're extremely strategic in the way that they're organized. So in the beginning, we start to talk about the issue very much, the reports, having people from the community present, and then move to really hone in on what the recommendations are, and then by the end they should have voted and vetted and be in agreement on what the recommendations are. And there's a lot of in-between kind of follow-up between meetings that goes on too. So then is really the time to focus in on the recommendations and to educate the policymakers on what the recommendations are and why they came to be. And the way that we do that is typically through at least one final report. Sometimes there's more than one. And they are distributed to all state and local policymakers and to the media and the public. And then we work alongside any of the local agencies that we partner with to talk to policymakers about the recommendations. And then the last is where the magic happens. I'm sure, have you guys seen that, the cartoon where they have like, and then the miracle occurs? That's when the miracle occurs, is when it's implemented, right? So implementation typically, hopefully, follows after the policymakers have had a chance to kind of grab hold of the evidence and think about opportunities within their own legislature to move something through. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened in Pennsylvania and then move to give you some information about what's going on at the national level. So in Pennsylvania, what was developed was a public-private partnership. There's a big image here of TRF, which stands for the Reinvestment Fund, which is a local community development financial institution who was our banking financing partner in this work. So as the project came to be implemented, the food trust role moved from one of kind of convening and supporting to taking on the application process and supporting the outreach and communication about the initiative to the communities and letting everyone know how they could apply and kind of, you know, supporting that process for application. And then the reinvestment fund was really the financial side of it. So they were responsible for really taking on the risk with the applicants. These were grants and loans, and so, you know, it was real money that they were having to deal with here. When it came to our role, we were responsible for making sure that the customers, that the proposals were really coming in for areas that were truly underserved. And we did not have a concrete, you know, black and white definition for that. We did a lot of kind of on the ground talking to people about who would go across the street or not across the street and, you know, getting into more of the depth of the community and also taking into account what the community wanted. So there were certainly instances across the state where an operator wanted to come in with a more low budget store, we'll say, and customers really wanted a full service store with, you know, pharmacy and deli and everything else. And so in those situations, we did actually turn the operator down or, you know, try and solicit another operator to come in and compete for the project. So I know this slide's pretty crowded, but these are the kinds of questions that we typically get asked about the initiative. So how many projects have been funded in Pennsylvania? We had 203 applications to date. The project is still alive. We're hopeful that there'll be another round of funding in this year's budget. There are 88 have been approved for funding, so that means we've had 88 projects really come about as a result of this initiative. TRF will also tell you that the closing rate for stores has only been 5%, whereas the average for industry is 25%. And they'll also tell you that if you had invested in this as opposed to the stock market, you would have done better with them. Projects have also been approved for funding in over half of the counties, so I think there's a little bit of a misperception that this is only an urban solution, and the truth is that we've had a lot of operators come in different forms from different places, including a lot of rural. And the next bullet I have here is, actually here it's a little bit lower, but that the funds support traditional supermarkets, but they also support non-traditional supermarkets. So we were very strategic in calling this a supermarket initiative because oftentimes industry has a very powerful lobby. Certainly your unions have a pretty powerful lobby. And so in terms of making a case, a compelling case for why you needed a funding, it was a lot more compelling to talk about funding supermarkets, and you had a lot of the support at the policy level to make that kind of argument, than it is to talk about funding co-ops. You know, it's not as sexy of kind of a proposition, I think, at a policy level. But at the same time, we made the legislation broad enough that it could support farmers markets and co-ops and other things at the end of the day, corner stores as well. And so what do the store projects look like? We're talking about, you know, typical large square foot stores in urban. Rural stores were a little bit smaller, and also a significant employment boost to the local economy as well. So this is a little bit blurry, I apologize, but basically what this is the map that I showed you earlier of the areas with greatest need and where the stores came in just the Philadelphia neighborhood. So you can get a pretty good sense that we were targeting the areas of greatest need. It's not one for one. This wasn't our goal to like plop them in the red box. It was more to serve as communities that knew that that we knew needed them. But I think at the end of the day, it did match up pretty well. And the kinds of evaluation data that we've collected is primarily on jobs, commercial food retail space, housing prices, all of which have shown some notable growth. Public health data is less well-defined at this point. My next slide has a number of studies that are in the field right now. I'll slide to that. So there's one that's been in the field for a really long time. It's like the joke of the natural experiment because the Progress Plaza store was one of the first to be funded as part of the initiative back in 2004. And due to a whole bunch of logistical problems, it now is going to be one of the last stores to be built. So we collected our baseline data and really thought that we would have findings to give you like 4 years ago, but it's still kind of in the works. And more recently, there's an NIH study that was funded in the Hill District in Pittsburgh that seems to be getting off the ground here in the next few months. And I just was talking to Brian earlier today, and he's going to be doing an evaluation of a store in New York. There's a New York initiative that's just going on. So I got my 1 minute heads up, so I'm going to go a little faster now. But anyway, so basically, here's all the states that are considering replication efforts and the status that they're in. Pennsylvania, obviously, has been going on for a while. New York just kicked off a program in September, and they are accepting applicants, and we're going to have a similar initiative going on there. New Orleans also has a program funded and is in the process of being structured. Illinois, you know that governor's race was hardcore, but we pulled through, and we're really hopeful that the Capitol bill will hopefully get released now, and the funding is in that. So Colorado and New Jersey are also in a task force process, and then Georgia, Texas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Minnesota, Massachusetts, all the M states, and Arizona, we're kind of doing that groundwork phase. So just briefly, I know people are really interested in the Healthy Fresh Food Financing Initiative, which is basically mirrors the Pennsylvania Fresh Food Financing Initiative. And so the 2011 budget that President Obama put forth includes a $345 million request for a Healthy Food Financing Initiative. And the way that's actually broken down is through a $50 million allocation from the USDA, $20 million from Health and Human Services, and then through Treasury and the CDFI Fund, that's Community Development Financial Institutions. There's $25 million and then $250 million in new market tax credits. That's what MMTC stands for. And I should say that this is also a partnership between PolicyLink, us, and TRF, this national org. And right now the Treasury NOFA has been released, which is basically a before RFA. So if you know CDFI that might be interested in tapping into these funds, it's really important that they go in and they check a box. That's all it is. It's a box they need to check. If they don't check the box, they won't be eligible to receive the funds. And the link is here if you know CDFI who wants to apply. At the end of the day, though, we still need to get support to formally pass this through Congress. It's obviously not a done deal, especially now that we've had change in the legislature. So our lessons learned are really to stay focused on one thing. You know, we do at the Food Trust a whole range of stuff, and we care about a lot of things more than just supermarkets. But as we move forward with this initiative, we've learned that getting everyone to focus on one issue at a time seems to me more functional in terms of getting progress on an issue than it is to continue to kind of debate whether or not we should focus on one thing versus another. And there's certainly opportunity to have subcommittees that are focused on different things, but the more focused you can be, the better. Engaging industry, they want to work with us. We found that in our corner stores as well, and certainly other sectors as well. Economic development folks, planning, you know. So at the end of the day, what's next? I think the most significant thing here is that we're starting now to take on some studies looking at the extent of marketing and merchandising efforts within stores. So a lot of folks have been concerned that you're building stores, there's a lot of junk in these stores, it's not just all about produce. How are we going to be able to track, monitor what people are buying? So we're working on some merchandising and marketing efforts inside stores and seeing if we can, you know, manipulate the environment there to shift people toward healthier items within a store. Thank you.
Thanks, Allison. So we're going to have all our speakers, each of our speakers, to come up. We have about 10 minutes for questions. If you could come to the mic. Oh, okay.
Notice all my reports are the grocery gap.
And as someone who lives in the desert, finds the desert very hunting and beautiful, and it gives the impression that it's just a wasteland, and I have a hard enough time with people in Arizona believing that, let alone the rest of the country. So that's my little soapbox. I do have a question. New York City, I understand, is proposing to get a waiver to administer
I'd love to talk about that. I am very strongly against that. And while it makes perfect technical sense to say that people using to not subsidize soda even more than we already do with SNAP dollars, I think the cost to human dignity is too great. I think both in a literal sense, I used to be on WIC, and it was very complicated. I needed all of my education and will to be able to figure out how to buy what I could buy and not what I couldn't. And so certainly at the register, it will be way more complicated than it appears to outsiders. But even though that wasn't the case, there are so many ways that we need to tackle these issues, and doing something that further stigmatizes and takes away control from people who are already stigmatized and that we oppress systematically, I think would backfire in the end in terms of health, because public health is the public's health, and people should create their own health, and I think that just further erodes any sense of personal agency in doing that. And I would much rather invest in personal agency than take away more. And I think the short-term benefits will way outweigh the costs, even in a narrow health sense. That's my.
Anybody else? Okay. Any other questions?
One thing I also wanted to mention at the time, too, and this is some feedback that we've received from some of the states. Some states will look at the report and say, oh, wait, we have a policy. And one thing I wanted to note, there actually may be more states that have policies at the time, but this was at the time of our release. There were 8. So for examples of the policies, it can include anything from being able to upgrade equipment at existing stores, or to make fruits and vegetables increase shelf space at stores, or point of decision prompts, and then also through provisions to bring new stores into underserved areas. So it was kind of, I don't know if that answers your question at all, or. Sure, I think, and I can't recall some of the specific language, and I can follow up with you later on that, but just increasing, point of decision or making fruits and vegetables more visible within the store, and they're not kind of hidden in the back or something like that, but I can follow up if you are interested in more specific the language. Or
okay. I can give you examples of our 4 states. I don't know if they're the same as our 8 states, but like our states, for example, they would be able to apply if you have an operator, right, a supermarket operator who wants to come into a neighborhood, he would put in an application, could receive up to $250,000 of loan funding or grant funding, depending on the kind of application that he have, and they may also be able to leverage other tax credits for helping him upstart the store. And what can he use that money for? Well, he could use that money, or she. Frankly, a lot of these people are guys, but they could use the money for anything having to do with equipment, training. A lot of people use it to do training, job training in stores. Like if you're going into a new neighborhood, you might have people in the neighborhood that haven't had jobs for a long time, or a lot of people who have been in the prison system and need, coming out, need more training. So they could use the dollars for that kind of work. So it's really very open, but it could be grant or loan funding, and they just apply through the program. That's one example. And that's pretty consistent across New York, Illinois, Louisiana, and Pennsylvania.
So that also, as far as policies or legislation, it can really encompass a broad area from increasing staff time for existing programs or being increasing time to actually start a program, being able to incorporate local procurement into districts or schools. I'm trying to think. I don't know if that, and I can likewise send you some more specifics, but that's just a quick snapshot. Does that help? They're on our website. Uh-huh. Right, for food policy councils and healthier food retail. Thank you, Jen. And they have, it's not all-encompassing, but there are some specific highlights from our states and then contacts of the state fruit and vegetable or nutrition coordinators there that can provide further information.
Can you just, like,
I don't have the exact link, but it's the
dumb. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we probably have time for just one additional question.
Basically, we never liked it. We've not liked it for a lot of reasons, and we very strategically in the beginning decided not to use it. One reason why we didn't like it is because we felt like it, especially in like urban areas, calling somebody like a desert versus a non-desert just seemed a little, I don't know, it didn't seem equitable to talk about people and the places they lived in a way that maybe, you know, was barren or I don't know. I mean, we didn't really get to the Arizona kind of question of people who love the desert and embrace the desert, but you know, we were going more for it seemed kind of just inappropriate term. We just never really liked it. And we made a decision really early on that we weren't using it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you to all of our speakers.